Today in Studio 360, the movie Gravity is both quietly beautiful and an awesome roller coaster ride.
Do you copy?
Yes, I copy, I'm detached.
And it's nominated for 10 Oscars. But Gravity's director, Alfonso Cuarón, doesn't think of his movies as his beloved children, more like ex-wives.
They gave me so much, I gave them so much, we love each other so much, but now we parted ways, we don't see each other.
And we'll hear about a great country singer who, back in the Betty Crocker 1950s, got real about women and love.
Making believe.
Laura Cantrell channels the queen of country music, Kitty Wells. That and more is ahead today in Studio 360, right after this.
Support for Studio 360 comes from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Next week, the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences hands out 3 Oscars to the best short films. Well, right now at Studio360.org, we've got our own short movie competition going on.
Hello.
We call it
Wes Craven Presents Studio 360's Scary Short Film Fest.
The rules for this listener challenge are simple. Make a scary film that's 30 seconds or less. Filmmaker and master of horror Wes Craven will judge the submissions. We've already got a bunch of good ones, including Every House Has a History from Charlie Thompson in Chatham, New Jersey. It stars a young genius who can see the horrors of all those who lived in his house before him.
Sometimes I know I can see things that other people can't. Remember, I can tell things happened.
And that's just one of 3 scary shorts that Charlie has already sent us. So now it's your turn. We want to see your super short scary movie. It can be live action, animation, even documentary. It's entirely up to you. Submit your movie and check out the ones we've gotten so far at studio360.org/scary-shorts. The deadline is March 2nd at midnight, and Wes Craven will be back on the show to announce the winner.
Hashtag scary shorts.
Explorer, this is Houston.
Go ahead, Houston.
Mission abort.
One of the scarier films of the year isn't a horror movie at all. It's Gravity, starring Sandra Bullock and George Clooney as astronauts on a mission that goes wrong. Most of the movie takes place in zero gravity, and these incredible continuous shots capture extraordinary you-are-there action. Action that isn't as big and cartoony as other special effects blockbusters, but packs way more punch.
Houston, this is Mission Specialist Ryan Stone. I am off structure and I'm drifting. Do you copy? Anyone?
The movie's up for 10 Oscars, including 3, Best Picture, Best Director, Best Editing, for Alfonso Cuarón, who previously made Y Tu Mamá También, Children of Men, and the 3rd Harry Potter movie. The action in Gravity is relentless, but the film's story is pretty simple, austere. There are no cutaways down to Earth or mission control. These astronauts are truly, utterly alone. When Cuarón came by the studio last fall, I asked him about that.
The idea was that it's almost a metaphorical journey. Outer space is a metaphor of the inner space of our character. So in that sense, there's a certain intimacy about the whole thing. As Jonas Cuarón, my co-writer, kept on saying, in one hand has to do this roller coaster.
Who is a relative of yours, by the way.
Yeah, he's my son. little detail. It has to be a roller coaster of a ride filled with suspense and tension. But by the same token, it has to be this emotional journey. One has to inform the other. We cannot be stopping to have now our dramatic moment and then cut to the chase, but everything has to be all together and organic. We defined that the thematic of the film was about adversities. Adversities takes you out of your comfort zone, tend to make you drift, and you can start drifting into the void, not unlike our character. So it was through this process that we were planning this journey, that is this roller coaster ride, that all that thematic element is expressed through visual metaphors.
So when you start off with this story in which the actors are going to be floating in space the whole time, something that has never been filmed for a whole movie before, how long did you think it would take to get it made?
I always say that it was a miscalculation. When I finished the screenplay, I thought it was going to be something very straightforward with a fair amount of visual effects. And it was not until we start kind of grounding the screenplay into how we're going to do it that we realized that the technology didn't exist to make the film we wanted to make. A long journey of invention and research began.
And as you were going through that process, did you and your partners ever think about giving up?
It was a whole journey of discovery. So you just keep on learning and failing and having great finds. And so it was a process of exhilaration and frustration.
With practically every big movie now loaded with visual effects, it's kind of hard to amaze audiences. But in Gravity, you do it straight out of the box. The first shot is almost a quarter hour long. Was that always the intention, open the movie with one super long continuous shot?
Well, that was the suggestion already from the screenplay. And the goal of that first shot was first to observe everything objectively, the way that you would observe an IMAX documentary. And then you see a routine mission with some astronauts doing some work.
And just doing small talk as they do.
Small talk and stuff. And eventually the camera, when disaster strikes, our character starts rolling away into the void. The camera keeps on following this character objectively until there's a point in which the camera finally locks with the character. And now the camera is rolling together with the character.
Right.
Eventually, the camera goes into the POV of the character. And the whole theory is that once that we come out of that POV, the camera is not objective, is not subjective. The camera is the POV of the audience. So we have now the audience journeying in space with the other astronauts. And I'm happy people talk about the long shot deals and stuff, but for me that's a little irrelevant. It's not a look, mama, no hands kind of shot. You know, every shot has its meaning and its purpose. This film would be a completely shallow if it was not for the biggest visual effect here, that is the performance of Sandra Bullock.
In order to pull off this visual trick of actors looking as though they're floating in zero gravity the whole time, you had to film them in these extremely controlled contraptions with actors on wires and mechanical rigs and computer-controlled lights everywhere. Did Sandra Bullock and George Clooney have any flexibility to act?
Well, the big challenge for the actors was that everything was pre-programmed. Pre-programmed robots that were carrying the camera and the lights, pre-programmed rigs for the actors that they were actually very straining for them. And the room for change was minimum.
So they were just extras in the robot picture.
Well, it's the opposite, because the important thing here was more like a ballet in which the actors, they have to memorize a very precise choreography. It was an exercise about abstraction because they were performing against nothing. So the beauty of that is that they rehearsed so much that when we were in the set, everything was just about performance. Again, like a dancer that when he's finally on stage, all of that hard work is secondhand to the expression.
It's also, naturally, this film in 3D, and it's maybe the first film I've seen since Avatar where I thought, like, this used 3D in a fantastic way. Also, the sound is a very 3D experience. I want to play a clip where things start going bad and this storm of dead satellites is hurtling toward the characters and their shuttle.
From a BSE sat. Dr.
Stone requesting faster transport.
We have to go, go, go.
Kennedy reports meteorological conditions. Don't go.
requested Explorer copy.
Explorer, Dr. Stone requesting faster transport to Bay Area. Explorer, do you copy?
Explorer, permission to retrieve Dr. Stone.
Here go for him. Houston, Explorer, copy.
All right.
We've lost Houston.
Look, we need to get the hell out of here.
Need some help there, man.
No, don't wait for us.
That was George Clooney and Sandra Bullock dealing with space chaos in Gravity. How did you approach making a sound-rich movie in, of course, what is absolutely silent space?
Well, the actual sound effects, we were very literal about following the rules of physics, that there's no sound in space. You can hear whenever there's an interaction between our character and objects, because the vibrations would travel to the ear and the brain. But then we use music. There was this German composer called Stockhausen. And Stockhausen had these pieces in which audiences were in the hall, but the orchestra was not on stage. It was scattered around the hall. And when the music started, they start playing, but then they start moving around. And it would create these dynamics. And that's what we tried to reproduce with the surround sound.
You could afford to take up one of Richard Branson's Virgin Galactic flights next year when they start. Will you do that?
If your station sponsors me, I'll be so happy. We can do a direct link when I'm up
really?
There.
Really? We can start a Kickstarter get the $250,000?
Exactly, yeah.
Well, let's talk about that. When people talk about your films, they mention, you say, there are all of these long, slow, real-time tracking shots in Y Tu Mamá También, in Children of Men, now in this. Did you start doing that partly as a reaction to what was happening in the 80s as you were growing up and this quick cut thing became the way movies are the new cinematic language?
I enjoy montage. I enjoy editing. I don't have a riff with that. I have a riff against point of view. It's just a lot of footage put together and trying to create certain energy and stuff with a lot of cuts.
And they're just cutting the music or whatever.
Yes, and that bothers me quite a lot. Another thing that I've been exploring with Lubezki, the director of photography for many films now, is this tension between character and context and environment. So character and environment, they have the same weight. You know, so that's the reason I don't favor close-up that much.
One of the movies you made before everybody knew who you were and you were a big famous movie director was A Little Princess, based on the novel by Frances Hodgson Burnett. I want to play a short clip from it in which the main character is defending her imagination and princesshood.
I am a princess. All girls are. Even if they live in tiny old attics, even if they dress in rags, even if they aren't pretty or smart or young, they're still princesses. All of us. Didn't your father ever tell you that? Didn't he?
That was from A Little Princess, 1995. A lot of people, including my daughters, still love that film. And I read that it's your favorite of all your films?
Ever since I finished my films, I never see them again.
I read that too, which is interesting.
But this one is, I just have a very good memory out of it and the energy of that film.
And I also read that unlike authors who say consider every novel their baby or filmmakers every movie is my child, not you. You say that they're like your ex-wife.
Yeah. They gave me so much. I gave them so much. We love each other so much, but now we parted ways. We don't see each other. If my ex-wife is in trouble, obviously I would go immediately.
So they weren't acrimonious divorces?
You know, No. It's just the same here. If suddenly I know that my negative is going to be burned, yeah, I try to go and rescue it.
So you've done the Princess movie, the adaptation of a classic, the coming-of-age movie, the franchise installment, the dystopian sci-fi film, now this visual effect spectacular. Do you have like a genre checklist and you just check, next one?
No, that would be maybe that would be helpful because it's one of those things you just do what you think is the right thing to do.
And what's the right next thing? And will it be once more something unlike what you've done before?
Probably. I never thought, you know, it's because I don't really revisit my films, so I don't really know much about what they have in common or not.
Well, I can remind you what you've done before if you want.
No, please don't.
Alfonso Cuarón, thank you very much.
Hey, thank you, Kurt. Thank you very much. It was fun.
Gravity is up for 10 Oscars. If it wins Best Picture, it'd be the first science fiction film ever to do so. And Alfonso Cuarón would be the first Best Director from Mexico. Coming up...
Thank the Oscars. That's why we came to you.
I never won an Oscar.
And that's a damn shame.
He's the most enduring star in Hollywood, recognized all over the world, immortalized in gold. But who was Oscar?
Well, he was apparently great friends with John Wayne. He supposedly taught Rudolph Valentino to tango. He told John Steinbeck the story that became the novella The Pearl. He's a bit like a Forrest Gump.
The real man behind the little statue. That's next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Support for Studio 360 comes from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson.
And the Oscar goes to...
I'll admit it. Watching the Oscar ceremonies is one of those national rituals that I love, even when the clichés pile up and the show drags on and on. So this year, let's make a virtue out of that, okay?
Thank you, Academy member!
At Studio360.org, we've got an Oscars bingo game. Instead of squares for B9 or N27, our squares say things like, puts on glasses for teleprompter, and Bono being Bono-ish. You can download your own special bingo card from our website or play right on your computer or phone. I'll be playing along, too. I'm a pad player myself, and checking in about the show on Twitter. We've got everything you need for Oscars bingo at Studio360.org.
And the Oscar goes to...
Bingo! It's officially the Academy Awards, of course. We all call it the Oscars because of the statue, which has not changed a bit since the late 1920s. That Art Deco shape, plated in gold. But those pecs, those thighs, those shoulders, they came from a real guy. And no, his name wasn't Oscar. Posey Gruner has the story.
They called him El Indio. And in Mexico, he's kind of a big deal. His real name was Emilio Fernandez, and he was one of Mexico's greatest directors.
Y ahora ya conoces la historia de esta tierra, que es la historia de toda la tierra de México.
He died in 1986, and his home in Mexico City has been turned into a museum.
La puerta del indio.
Cristobal Arias Gómez is the historian there.
Bueno, el indio es una persona, un personaje consagrado.
El indio is a sacred figure. It's like he's already made it into history for all the great work he's accomplished.
Together with his muse, Dolores del Rio, and his cinematographer, Gabriel Figueroa, Fernandez made some of the best films from the golden age of Mexican cinema. Emilio Fernandez led a big life, and he told some big stories.
Well, he was apparently great friends with John Wayne. He told John Steinbeck the story that became the novella The Pearl. He supposedly taught Rudolph Valentino to tango. He's a bit like a Forrest Gump.
Dolores Tierney teaches film at the University of Sussex. She wrote a book about Fernandez. She believes some of his stories. As for the story that he posed for the Oscar, she finds it persuasive.
This one seems to be quite true because there are a number of things that point to its veracity.
For example... Fernandez had a great physique.
A legendary physique, according to many of his biographers.
Tierney has a photo of Fernandez that was taken when he was young. He's standing in swim trunks, and he kind of looks like the Oscar.
You know, very broad chest, very slim waist. You know, very similar to the Oscar statuette.
Even his nose seems kind of Oscar-like.
Not broad, not thin, A kind of a distinguished nose, I'd say.
And Fernandez had that same bearing, that way of thrusting his shoulders back.
Era un personaje robusto. Era un personaje atlético en su
época. He had a robust, athletic figure. He went to the military academy. And so he had a unique type of body, a body that was very unusual for people to have at the time. So obviously that's why he was chosen to be the model for the Oscar.
It's kind of funny how it all happens. So here's the story. Fernandez grew up in Mexico. And in 1923, when Pancho Villa was killed, Fernandez dropped out of military college to join the Huertista rebels. When they lost, he got 20 years in prison. He only escaped because he jumped the border, and he landed in Hollywood. At that time, in the mid-20s, it was just a little movie town. But lucky for Fernandez, there were lots of roles for Mexican extras. And like Hollywood itself, Fernandez had some big ambitions.
He kind of realized that he wanted to be a filmmaker. So he said he was learning his trade and he would pay other extras for their call. So if they got a call to be on a movie for, I don't know, a dollar a day, he'd say, I'll pay you $2. I want your call.
And then in 1928, when he was working on the movie Ramona, he laid eyes on Dolores Del Rio. Dolores Del Rio was also from Mexico, but she was way out of his league. She came from old money in Mexico City, and she was already a star. In fact, that's her voice you hear, right there. And then one day, on the set of Ramona, she noticed him.
El indio estaba en la banca de los extras bailarines.
El indio was sitting with the extras at the dancers' bench, and Dolores del Río gets up, points to him, and says to her assistant, I forgot my coat at the other end of the studio.
Dile a ese indio, dice Dolores.
Tell that Indian to get my coat. That was the moment he took his nickname, El Indio.
It was technically true. Fernandez was half Kickapoo on his mother's side, but it wasn't exactly a compliment. Now, here comes the funny coincidence. At the same time that Emilio Fernandez was mooning over Dolores Del Rio, Dolores Del Rio was about to become engaged to MGM art director Cedric Gibbons. Cedric Gibbons was one of the 36 founding members of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, and it was his job to design an award that they could hand out. He'd already sketched an idea, but he needed a statue, not a drawing, so he asked the sculptor George Stanley to make it in 3 dimensions. And this is where Fernandez enters the picture. Some stories say Gibbons happened to have Fernandez's casting photo on his desk. Other stories say Dolores Del Rio tipped him off. But in all the stories, when Gibbons approaches Fernandez to ask if he'll pose,
él se niega a posar
El Indio para, refused. He refused to pose for the sculptor because he had to do it in the nude.
He was a little bit of a bit of a prude.
A prude with a huge crush.
Ya se sabía que el Indio Fernández tenía un cariño o una atención especial.
Everybody knew that el Indio Fernández was fond of Dolores del Río, that he kind of had a thing for her.
Entonces, todo esto se confabula.
So everything comes into place, and it's Dolores del Río who goes to Emilio Fernández and asks, will you please pose for the sculpture so he can finish the trophy?
That did the trick. Fernández posed, Stanley sculpted, and they made a mold. They sent that mold to the California Brass Foundry.
And the Oscar goes to...
In the time since then, more than 3,000 Fernandezes have been cast, buffed, and dipped in gold. Eventually, both Fernandez and Del Rio went back to Mexico. Fernandez started working as a director, and when Del Rio's life in Hollywood fell apart, Fernandez offered her a role. They made many movies together, but the greatest of them all was Maria Candelaria. Fernandez wrote it for Del Rio as a birthday gift, and in the role he wrote for her, she's an indigenous woman, ese indio. In some ways, it's a lot like the Oscar story. In the movie, Maria Candelaria poses for an artist, except this time, when the artist asks Maria Candelaria to pose nude, she refuses, and she doesn't budge. The movie won the Palme d'Or at Cannes in 1946. As for the Oscar, El Indio Fernandez never did get to take one home. For Studio 360, I'm Posey Gruner.
And the Oscar goes.
And the Oscar goes to.
And the Oscar goes to.
The Oscar goes to.
You can see what Emilio Fernandez looked like at Studio360.org. As for how it got to be called Oscar, nobody really knows. Maybe we'll try to sort that out for next year. I don't usually have a strong favorite for best documentary, but this year, I absolutely do. The nominee that knocked me out is called The Act of Killing. It's about one of the most horrific incidents of the Cold War when hundreds of thousands of Indonesians were killed in an anti-communist purge. But instead of telling the story conventionally through its victims, the film is entirely from the perspective of its unpunished, unrepentant perpetrators. The American filmmaker Joshua Oppenheimer asked Death Squad leaders to reenact some of their brutality, and they were happy to oblige. The result is a surreal, disturbing, absolutely astonishing film, one of a kind. Oppenheimer had originally set out to make a much more conventional documentary based on stories of survivors.
But every time I would film with the survivors, we would be stopped. The military would come and stop us. They would take our equipment. They would arrest us. They would detain us. And it was very difficult to get anything done. And so we went back to the Indonesian human rights community with the survivors with whom I was working and said, is it a good idea to make this film? Can we make this film? Is it too soon? Is it too sensitive? Is it too dangerous? Everybody said, no, you're onto something extremely important. We need a film that exposes for Indonesians themselves the nature of this regime, the kind of normality built atop a mass grave, so that Indonesians themselves can stop denying what they already know to be the case, essentially creating the space for Indonesians themselves to start talking about what really happened and the consequences of that for the present.
Because there have been no reconciliation commissions as in, for instance, South Africa.
Oh, exactly, because the men who've done it are still in power.
Well, and so once you decided talking to the survivors is proving impossible, had you already talked to these now elderly perpetrators and already won their confidence?
When I was working with the survivors, they would occasionally send me on these sort of missions to film, meet perpetrators who they thought would talk to me, who they suspected had killed their relatives. So I was sent on these quite painful missions. And when I would meet these perpetrators, they would boast invariably.
Really?
Yeah, they would. I would walk.
So that wasn't just the few you put in the film. This was their standard MO.
Exactly. And then I was, and then once it was impossible to continue with the survivors, too difficult, too dangerous, then one of the main survivors with whom I was working said, Josh, continue to film the perpetrators. They will boast like the ones you've already met. They will appear to be proud, as though intuiting that they may not really be proud. And in their boasting, the audience will see exactly why we're so afraid and the nature of this regime. So from that point on, I filmed every perpetrator I could find across the region. And they were all boastful. They were all eager to tell me what they've done. And not just that, they would say, I guess you want to see where I did it. And they would take me to the places where they killed, show me how they'd gone about it, launch into these spontaneous demonstrations.
And at what point did you come up with this idea of them reenacting in this Hollywood-y way the various scenes of their brutality and killings?
Well, before I met the main character, Anwar, when I was still working in my way across the countryside, I was already saying to people very openly, look, you've participated in one of the biggest killings in human history. Your whole society's based on it. Your lives are shaped by it. You want to show me what you've done in these simple demonstrations. Show me what you've done in whatever way you wish. I will film the process, film the demonstrations to try and understand what this means to you and your society. So I was quite open. The method was very much we would shoot a scene, screen it for Anwar and his friends, and they would think about what to shoot next. And I think maybe the core drama of the film comes when he realizes that he can't make a portrait of himself which is at once beautiful and true.
Well, and it makes for this one of the many jaw-dropping moments in this film of – because it's harrowing to think this is a man who killed people in just this way. Now we're reenacting it in this kind of over-the-top Hollywood-looking way. It's goofy as well as chilling.
I think humor plays a really important role in the film. It's not a, I mean, for some people it's utterly painful, and I think in the end it's painful, but it is a funny film.
And the audience, after a while, frees itself to laugh, sort of.
And I think there's two kinds of humor in the film. Of course, there's these moments of surreal absurdity where you just see a whole regime being unmasked in the most shameless way, and it is absurd and funny, like a scene where Anwar envisions his redemption in heaven, and there waiting for him are his victims with a medal who thank him for killing them and sending them to heaven.
Which is amazing. Now, was that his idea?
That was his idea, and it was a direct response to him having played a victim in a previous scene and felt a kind of trauma.
Well, and this regular screening of essentially not the dailies, but of finished scenes to this guy, this former killer, is extraordinary to watch him and his little grandchildren watching it. But it also, in a journalistic way, as an audience member, I'm thinking the filmmakers didn't lie or trick anybody. He's fully aware of what this film is.
Yeah, that's right. You know, every reenactment, every dramatization implied a denial of the moral meaning of what he had done. I mean, you can't make a cowboy scene about hundreds of people being killed and not be in denial of the true meaning of that action. And so to make the scene was a kind of insistence on that denial. And then I would screen the material back wondering if Anwar might recognize some of the things of which he was in denial in the kind of mirror of the movie. And each time, I think he would, but he wouldn't have yet the courage to know to express that, and he would displace it into the next scene. And so it wasn't a surprise, ultimately. In hindsight, it's not surprising that the fiction scenes themselves, which I saw as these kind of allegories for impunity, ultimately became this kind of prism through which he would somehow confront his broken self.
And he seems finally, in one particular scene, to do that in a very, he gets emotional way. Having spent so much time with him going through this process, did you feel this is real? He's not playing me in some way?
Yeah, I knew at the very end it's real, but there's a moment just before it becomes real where he is really playing, where he says, I think in desperation, when he's finally forced to confront what he's done, he offers this kind of generic confession where he says, now I feel what my victims feel, don't I? And of course, if I said yes then, it would reassure him that what his victims went through was no worse than being in a movie. And I am very grateful that at that moment there was nothing technical like lighting or sound to distract me, and I could just be in my heart and listen to him and be present and say, no, of course you're not feeling what your victims felt, because what they went through was so much, much, much worse.
Which is about the only time you speak in the film at length, and has all the more power for it.
And I think in that moment, somehow the bottom drops out for him, and he's forced to gaze into the abyss, the unbridgeable abyss between all the unimaginable horror that he's put people through and all the stories he's told himself, all the lies that he and the whole regime has told itself to run away from what they've done. It's interesting, you asked this question, or you mentioned about Anwar seeing the film, knowing about the film. His reaction to the finished film was very interesting. Of course, he knew what was in it, so he knew it would be a painful experience to watch. For quite a while, he would say, I would say it's nearly finished, I want to show it to you because it's going to come out soon. He would say, I'm not ready to see it because maybe later, maybe later. Finally, I said to him, look, it's out. I have to tell you what's in it. You haven't wanted to see it. Then he found himself at the center of a very big news story in Indonesia. The film has made an enormous impact there. And he said, I need to see the film. So by then it was unsafe. I could no longer go to Indonesia safely. I could probably get in but would never get out again. I arranged for him to go to a place where there'd be good internet connection. I didn't know if I could bring him out of the country because he was now in the news as a mass killer. So we brought him to a place where I could be with him through the screening by Skype, and we sat together. He could talk to me throughout the screening, and at the end of the screening, he sat in this kind of stunned silence for a long time, tearful. Then he said, this film shows what it's like to be me, and it's an honest film, and I'm glad I was able to be so honest, and I will stand by the film. And it was a strange thing to say, except if you remember that he may come under real pressure to denounce the film.
Has it been seen widely in Indonesia, been released?
On the 10th of December, International Human Rights Day last year, they held 50 screenings in 30 cities, and that's grown exponentially since then. So by the 1st of April, there had been 500 screenings in 95 cities, and every week there's more than the previous week. But perhaps most gratifying has been the Indonesian news media. So, for example, Indonesia's leading news magazine, Tempo, published a special double edition about the film in which they gathered 75 pages of boastful testimony from killers all around the country, showing that basically the act of killing is a repeatable experiment, that there's tens of thousands of Anwars around the country.
Really? So this that's a happy ending, because it seems as though this film has sort of unlocked the silence.
Yeah, I think the film, it's not the only thing to be sure, but it has helped catalyze a sea change in how Indonesians talk about their past. It's like the child from the emperor's new clothes, walking the king and saying, look, the king is naked, and everybody knew it but was too afraid to say it. And now that it's been said so emotionally by the perpetrators themselves, there's no going back, and Indonesians therefore are talking for the first time openly and without fear to a degree, because the film has opened the way, and it's certainly the best part of completing the film.
And yet, as I've said from the beginning, it is this bizarre work of art. It is not at all the medicinal, earnest kind of documentary that listeners may think, yeah, I don't want to see that. It's in its powerful, strange, disturbing way, it's incredibly entertaining.
I think, in fact, that's why it's having the effect that it's having. You know, I talked about humor earlier. There's, I think, when Indonesians see these moments which we find absurd, crazy, for them it's the unmasking of the whole regime. So it's both terribly moving but also cathartic and joyful, because finally the regime is showing its true rotten logic.
Well, I encourage everyone to go see it. Joshua Oppenheimer, thank you very much.
It was a great conversation. Thank you.
The Act of Killing is up for an Oscar for Best Documentary. I talked with its director, Joshua Oppenheimer, last fall. Coming up, Kitty Wells was the queen of country music. It was the 1950s. She wore sweet gingham dresses. But if you listen closely, her songs tell a different story.
Don't claim to be an angel. My life's been full of sin.
Laura Cantrell channels Kitty Wells. That's up next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. You're listening to Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson.
But there's no way there from here. No bridge across the ocean.
This is the title track from a new record by the country singer-songwriter Laura Cantrell. It's called No Way There From Here. Cantrell comes by country honestly. She grew up in Nashville listening to the greats. When I talked with her a few years ago, she was working on a tribute to her hero, the country singer Kitty Wells.
I don't love you anymore.
In the 1950s, before Loretta and Tammy and Dolly, Kitty Wells was country. And she looked like a perfect old-fashioned girl, but she managed to sneak some pretty racy material into the Grand Ole Opry. Laura Cantrell and her band came by the studio to play one of the songs that caused such a ruckus back in Kitty's day. It's called I Don't Claim to Be an Angel.
Some folks will
try to poison your mind that my love can't be true. Many nights I lay awake, dear, hoping our love will last, wondering if your love is strong enough to forget about my past. I don't claim to be an angel. My life's been full of sin. But when I met you, darling, that all came to an end. Never doubt my love, dear, no matter what you do. I don't claim to be an angel, but my love for you. Haunting me all through the years, when I've paid for each mistake, dear, with millions of bitter tears. I don't claim to be an angel. My life's been full of sin. But when I met you, darling, that all came to an end. Don't claim to be an angel, but my love for you is true. No, I don't claim to be an angel, but my love for you is true.
Laura Cantrell and her band playing I Don't Claim to Be an Angel, which is on this record, Kitty Wells Dresses. So that song seems so unbelievably frank for the 1950s, for a country hit in the 1950s. This person, this woman saying, I had sex with people and I have a terrible past, but, you know, maybe you'll marry me anyway or maybe you won't. Was that a controversial thing when it was released?
You know, I think after the controversy of It Wasn't God Who Made Honky Tonk Angels, which
are your huge hit.
Right, was a huge hit. I think that that in a way it just opened the doors enough that you could say things that were frank but that were in a language that was, you know, sort of respectable enough.
Slightly oblique.
Yes, yeah, slightly oblique. It always really struck me how – if you really looked into the song, how candid it really was, yeah. And how it just kind of got through without being a controversy because the fuss had already blown over by the time this song came out because of the big, you know, ruckus that It Wasn't God Who Made Honky Tonk Angels had caused.
And give the listeners a sense of the ruckus that did cause.
Well, that came out in 1952. It was an answer song to a hit of the day called The Wild Side of Life, where a man's sort of lamenting his wife is running around in the honky-tonks and won't come home. And so he sort of blames God and says, I didn't know that God would do this to me. And Kitty, in her version, which, of course, the song itself was written by a man from down in Louisiana, she says in the lyrics of the song, it wasn't God who made honky-tonk angels. Don't blame all of women for what is happening in your marriage.
It wasn't God who made honky-tonk angels, as you said in the words of your song. Too many times married men think they're still single. That has caused many a good girl to go.
There was a moment where they thought, well, maybe we should try to kind of squelch this, you know, and we'll ban it. In fact, it did get banned from the nationally syndicated portion of the Grand Ole Opry. She couldn't perform it on that part
of
the show.
But the horse was kind of out of the barn,
right? It was gone. The horse was charging out down the in the fields. No, it was just was a huge hit. It was a jukebox hit. It was everywhere for a while.
People loved it.
People loved it, and it sold a ton of records. So from there, they actually, you know, Johnny Wright, Kitty Wells' husband, wrote I Don't Claim to Be an Angel. Imagine, you know, in that day, writing for your good church-going, you know, wife and mother of your three kids this song that says, I've had some experience, and sweetheart, you know, I'm going to tell you about it.
And you grew up listening to her. I mean, your father played her records, yeah?
Oh, absolutely. In my dad's family, they were big Opry listeners, and Kitty was their girl. And, you know, I have grandparents that were square dancers and, you know, really into the sort of experience of it.
One of my earliest memories is going with my parents to square dances in little towns. So I know that feeling.
Yep. It's, you know, something that I kind of knew firsthand how important she was to them.
Is Kitty Wells aware of this record?
Oh, yes, she is. I actually got a really wonderful chance to visit with her last summer when we were finishing mixing it. And it was very sweet for me because I'd written this song for her and I got to see her response to it. She and Johnny both, her husband, were very, very sweet and positive about it. And then when I explained to them I'd actually made a whole record in her honor, what was interesting to me was that they really just were curious about what songs I'd chosen and which ones were my favorites. And then as I explained to them, you know, why I'd pick certain songs, they just started singing them to me. It was so
sweet. What a wonderful moment.
Yeah, it was really like if we got, you know, no further than that moment, that would have been the pot of gold right there.
And that one original song that you played for her is Kitty Wells' Dresses.
That's right.
Why don't you play that now?
Great.
One, two, three.
Kitty Wells' Dresses, robes of the queen. Kitty Wells' Dresses,
Charles died in 2012. You can see a video of Laura Cantrell and her band playing live at studio360.org. Her new album is called No Way There From Here.
Robes of the Queen.
And that is it for this week's show. Thank you very much for listening. Don't forget, you've got just one more week to enter our Scary Shorts Film Festival. Your chance to impress Wes Craven with your super short horror movie. He's watching every nominee. The deadline is March 2nd at midnight. You can take a look at some of your competition at studio360.org/scaryshorts. Also, on Oscar night, come play bingo with us during the awards broadcast. You can get your own interactive bingo card at our website. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Jenny Lawton,
John Delore,
Sean Ramisferam,
Alana Harper,
Eric Malinsky,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Rose Connolly,
Eliza Martin,
Andres O'Hara Plotnick.
Special thanks this week to Beto Arcos and, as always, to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tiegum.
Studio 360 is supported in part by the SC Group, whose charitable resources include FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds at fjc.org, and by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, ArtWorks.
PRI, Public Radio International.
The Americans may be the only TV show about spies that's been created by a former spy.
Can I actually lie to people about what I do? I never had any doubts about it again. It just became part of me, and I lied all the time. Every day I was lying constantly.
Joe Weisberg gives up all sorts of information about his hit show, The Americans, next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.